Peer Review Print Speaking to the Blind, celebrating 40 years of audio newspaper production. Welcome to this week's edition of the Herald Scotland podcast, recorded at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre by our amazing volunteers. You can get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter or Instagram using @CuneReview, that is @CUEANDREVIEW. You can also contact us directly by emailing information@cunereview.com. That is information CUEANDREVIEW.com. Or by calling 0141 772 3976. That's 0141 772 3976.
From the Herald, Thursday the 26th of October, from the Voices section, opinion. Shame on USA for selling out the poor for middle class votes. Article by Neil Mackay. Hamza Yousaf's positioning on council tax makes zero sense unless seen through the prism of cynical electoral calculus. It's perhaps worth considering the word calculus here, not just in its mathematical sense, but also its Latin meaning, small pebble. In ancient days, little stones were used to cast votes. Yousaf's council tax policy is designed with one thought, safeguarding the votes of Scotland's middle classes at the expense of the poor. Freezing council tax has angered COSLA, which represents Scottish councils, and upset USA's partners in government, the Greens. Trade unions are furious. The right-wing Taxpayers Alliance, though, is delighted. Policies are always best judged by those both for and against. USAF has sold out the poor of Scotland for a cheap round of applause at his party's conference. It was the act of a desperate man, a leader fearful of his own party and fully aware that the clock ticks on his political fate. The SNP, a party currently in the grip of mass delusion, has convinced itself that freezing the council tax is somehow progressive. It's nothing of the sort. Council tax is fundamentally regressive. The amoebas and the fleas and the dogs in the street know that. Freezing council tax simply maintains an unfair tax under the utterly galling pretense of social democracy. Yousaf and his party wear the clothes of social democracy like a child wears the clothes of its mother or father. Council tax benefits the rich. The Scottish Government itself said, the tax rate is higher for lower value properties and lower for higher value properties. The freeze also benefits the rich disproportionately more than the poor. Any savings made are an exercise in national self-harm. Which budgets will be slashed to make up the loss? Avoiding a 5% council tax rise would see the poorest households save less than £50 annually, the richest £150, figures which illustrate perfectly council tax inequity. Now, evidently, £50 matters to the poorest when mums and dads are going hungry to feed their children, in a country where food banks are as ubiquitous as charity shops. But for a party which poses as progressive, this simply isn't good enough. It debases fairness. It's not progressive to maintain taxes which benefit the rich over the poor, while claiming a freeze is delivering for people when they need it most. That's a lie. It's rank populism. There's only one possible equitable action when it comes to council tax. Scrap it and put progressive local taxation in its place. The SNP knows this. It has been promising council tax reform since it took power 16 years ago. It called council tax hated. Replacing council tax was a 2007 campaign pledge. It's broken its promises. It's lied. Stupidity is no excuse. It's not as if the SNP doesn't know how to fix council tax. The work has been done for it. All people have to do is read the STUC paper, Scotland Demands Better, Fairer Taxes for a Fairer Future. I recommend it to any reader who wants a ready reckoner to what levers the SNP can pull when it comes to Scottish taxation. The SNP often whines that it hasn't enough powers. Big bad London is to blame, Devolution isn't enough. Only independence will save Scotland. Lies again. There are many powers at the SNP's disposal. It just doesn't want to use them. A cynic would suspect a sleek SNP leadership believes that by pretending it's powerless and feigning grievance, it can ramp up independent support at the expense of effective policy. Others may feel that the SNP is a rather dictatorial strain and, if it can centralise power at will, slowly strangling councils across Scotland. It seems clear now that the SNP doesn't want to reform council tax as it has become the party of the establishment. It is the status quo, and the status quo is middle-class Scotland. Ergo, middle-class Scotland must always be appeased. Scrapping council tax and replacing it with a fairer tax could, evidently, risk middle-class votes. Those middle-class votes, incidentally, seem to be more about keeping the SNP in power, rather than furthering the cause of independence. The best replacement for council tax is a proportional property tax, PPT. Currently, council tax bans are based on house valuations from 1991, 3 decades ago when I was still at university, for pity's sake. PPT would clearly update the values of homes and see households pay a percentage of that value. An annual charge of 0.6% would raise an additional £489 million in revenue compared to council tax. If we divide Scotland into the richest and poorest, analysis of PPT shows that if the tax was levied at 0.6%, then, in terms of the impact on annual income, the poorest would gain. The middle class would see a very small decline, almost marginal across that income group. Only those with the highest incomes would dig a little deeper, but they can afford it. So bingo, it's a recipe for fairness across the board. What makes the current policy even more rotten is that the Scottish Government recently considered increasing the highest council tax bans, which offered at least a modicum of reform, but dumped the notion. There are few people in Scottish public life who seem trustworthy. Ross Foyer, SDC General Secretary, bucks the trend. Her team commissioned a study into council tax alternatives which the SNP, if it had half a brain and a quarter of a soul, could simply lift as a ready-made policy. Foyer describes failing to scrap council tax as a dereliction of duty by successive politicians. Use of freezing council tax was a disrespectful move of party political electioneering. The decision from the Scottish Government to revert to type is done out of short-sighted polling considerations rather than good governance or proficient public policy. If the First Minister is to stick to the progressive credentials he championed during his election campaign, policies we roundly support and will work with him on, he simply cannot roll back any further. Foyer is unquestionably right. Earlier this week, I wrote that the fundamental problem with politics is that the wrong people hold power. Perhaps Yousaf and Foyer illustrate the point more eloquently than I. And that article was by Neil Mackay. From the Herald, Thursday the 26th of October, Voices. What other country would allow such appalling neglect of its history? The letters page. Alison Rowett's question, Sir, why was I taught nothing about Scotland's history? The Herald, October 25th, was the same question I asked my teacher and, in reply, I was told not to be impertinent. The subjects Alison was taught, the Russian Revolution, Peterloo and so on, were the subjects I was taught. I kid you not, the word Scotland was not mentioned once in the 5 years before I sat my higher history. My children fared little better, although they were educated within a stone's throw of Bannockburn, Stirling Castle and the Wallace Monument. What other country in the world would have shown such appalling neglect of its past? And actually, it is not just Scotland's history of which so many children were left in ignorance. Apart from a nod to Burns, our literature and poetry are also not well enough known and properly taught in their own country, and are often better appreciated in countries around the world. Ruth Marr Stirling. Blame it on Anglicisation. Alison Rout states that she learned embarrassingly little about Scotland's past during her education. The answer can, I believe, be encapsulated in one word, Anglicisation. Confirmation of that is found, for example, in the comments of Lord Cooper in 1949, when he referred to the fact that a Scottish student could actually graduate in history without any knowledge of the history of Scotland. It is clear that the situation had not improved very much in the ensuing 40 years, when one had, in 1989, the Scottish Centre for Economic and Social Research, observing, Scottish children are probably unique in learning more about the history, literature and culture of another nation than they do of their own. Ian W. Thompson, Lindsay. The wisdom of our elders. Having been at school people rather earlier, I imagine, than Alison Rowett, these years being 1941 to 1952, I can attest to some degree of feelings in the teaching of purely Scottish history distinctly separate from British as a whole. I am sure this would equally apply to my peers in Welsh and Northern Ireland classrooms. Nevertheless, in secondary we had an excellent history teacher who did impart specific Scottish matters to us, particularly in regard of the Wars of Independence and the Jacobite Rebellions, stripping away much of the romanticised imagery that featured, as an example, in the works of such as Sir Walter Scott. After school hours there was much to be learned in library books if one was sufficiently interested. Most of my generation also benefited from listening at Granny's knee or other elderly relatives who, I would venture to say, had a far-reaching understanding in all subject matter that concerned Scotland in the past. John McNab, Falkirk. Enlightened by MacPhail, I was staggered to read that Alison Rowett had learned no Scots history at school. At secondary school in Edinburgh from 1957 to 1963, our standard history textbook was MacPhail's History of Scotland. We did also learn about events Firth of Scotland, but the core of our teaching was Scottish history. Eric Begbie, Stirling. Making the grade. Let me correct Alison Rowett. She wrote, I could blame school. I did history O-level and higher, and do not recall being taught anything about Scotland. I contend that she did not do history at O-level. She did history at O-grade. Savinio Camillo, Airdrie. The course of history. Unlike Alison Rowett, when I took higher history, the Darien Scheme and the Act of Union, advantages and disadvantages, now there's a can of worms, were part of the coursework. I can only assume that this is due to the fact that the events were still fresh in the memory when I sat the exam. Jim McSheffrey, Giffnock. An unwelcome mandate. Increasingly, net zero has been revealed for what it is, government direction of how people must live their lives, heat their homes, holiday and travel, and what and how much factories and commerce must produce and supply. Take the ZEV mandate, the zero emission vehicle mandate, for example. Although the Prime Minister changed the phase out date for purchasing new diesel and petrol cars from 2030 to 2035, he left the ZEV mandate in place. It takes effect from next year. In 2024, every manufacturer must ensure that at least 22% of their sales are electric. In 2025, that percentage rises to 28%, 33% in 2026, and 80% in 2030. If manufacturers fail to meet these arbitrary targets, unless they can purchase allowance from other manufacturers, unlikely since they are their competitors, they will be fined £15,000 for every diesel or petrol they sell above the target. If this is how a Conservative government behaves, I shudder to think what Labour will come up with as it tries to enact unhinged World Economic Forum's net zero accelerator. Willie Zelensky, Lauder. Extreme weather is nothing new. Reference Margaret Forbes' letter, October 23rd, I suggest you read a book entitled The Great Murray Floods of 1829. The Muckle Spate that occurred on August 4th, 1829 was the most extreme flood recorded in Scottish history and extended from Inverness in the north to Montrose on the east coast, and apparently its impact was severe with devastation to agriculture in the small towns widespread and extensive. Sir Thomas Dick Lauder at the time said, "Nature can seldom be regulated or controlled in one way without running riot some other." And what about Noah, who built an ark in preparation for the arrival of the flood that occurred circa 2350 BC? Extreme weather appears not to be a modern phenomena. Brian Bell, Kinross. The A levels. Ivan McGee, writing on the subject of progressive taxation. Progressive taxation needs to be much more than just a soundbite. The Herald, October 25th. Talks about digitisation of services, removal of duplication and complexity across quangos, and breaking down sub-optimising silos. Pardon me? And for those of us whose first language is English? No wonder we sometimes don't know what our MSPs are talking about. Bill Brown, Dumfries. And that was the letters page from the Herald Scotland on Thursday the 26th of October.
This is from the Herald Scotland on Thursday the 26th of October 2023 from the news section. Missing £128 million in ScotGov's take on Costa Ferris scandal. This article is written by Martin Williams. If you ask the Scottish Government what the estimated total capital cost of Scotland's ferry fiasco vessels was, you would be told it is £240 million. But that is over £120 million less than the actual costs to date of the much-delayed two ferries, which are still to be delivered by nationalised shipyard firm Ferguson Marine. But how can that be? It did not go unnoticed by one or two eagle-eyed ferry fiasco watchers who made contact to question why it was that there was an apparent anomaly after Ferguson Marine Chief Executive David Tideman appeared before Holyrood's Transport Committee this week. So the Herald decided to ask for some clarity. The Scottish Government, in quoting the shipyard firm's update, said that the total forecast cost to complete both ships is £240 million, excluding warranty costs, post-handing over, plus a worst-case contingency for additional costs ranging from £5 million to £30 million. But is there an explanation for the gap of over £120 million? When the Herald made inquiries, it turned out that the actual capital cost to date for building the two vessels is actually a whopping £368 million, over 3.5 times the original £97 million contract. The Scottish Government suggested that Ferguson Marine should explain the gap, as the numbers that they quote come from the shipyard firm that they control. The Herald has been told that the £128 million difference related to incurred costs from pre-nationalisation, when the shipyard was owned by tycoon Jim McColl and called Ferguson Marine Engineering Limited, FMEL. That is made up of a £45 million taxpayer-funded loan provided by the Scottish Government and £83 million in stage payments for the completion of the ferries made by Scottish Government-controlled Caledonian Maritime Assets Limited, CMAL, which owns and procures the nation's ferry fleet. One ferry user group official said that updates over the progress of the long-awaited ferries had always proved to be a headache. He said, "Quite how we can get such a muddled approach to what, when all is said and done, is public money, is bewildering, especially as there is so much intrigue around where the money, whatever the money is, has gone to." The costing analysis was described as opaque by Edward Mountain, the convener of Holyrood Transport Committee, which has been examining the progress of the ferries. He had put to Mr. Tideman at a committee meeting on Tuesday that the total actual capital costs to date was £350 million, while trying to do his own sums, before asking what the ship's actual market value would be. Mr. Tideman made no argument with his calculation, as he said that he thought the actual market figure was around £70 million each. Mr. Mountain replied with one word, "Wow." MSPs are continuing to raise concerns about why the Port Glasgow shipyard was awarded the contract under the ownership of then-independent supporting Mr. McColl to build the ferries Glen Sannox and Glen Rosa, with both vessels 6 years late and costs continuing to soar. Ministers were warned 5 years ago by their own advisers that they faced ploughing in millions more to prop up Scotland's crisis-hit nationalised shipyard firm after having twice stepped in to bail them out while under threat of going under. Consultants PwC told ministers in an analysis before ministers approved a second £30 million loan bailout that there remained further risks for Ferguson Marine, which may result in it needing further funding in the future. The Scottish Government procured advice from PwC to fashion two loan deals worth £15 million and then £30 million to the company, and said that they said the funds would soon be exhausted. The Scottish Government propped up the financially troubled yard twice in the space of a year in 2017 and 2018, having gone into administration 3 years earlier. It had been claimed that the disastrous £97 million contract to build two lifeline ferries was rigged in favour of the firm run by Mr. McColl, who rescued the yard in the summer of 2014, in a move partly brokered by former First Minister Alex Salmond, who kept the entrepreneur abreast of businesses that needed saving. The shipyard firm went into administration again in August 2019, just over a year after the second Scottish Government bailout loan, amidst soaring costs and delays in the construction of the two ferries, and was nationalised with Mr. McColl's Ferguson Marine and the Scottish Government-owned ferry procurer, CMAL, blaming each other for what went wrong. That article was written by Martin Williams. This is from the Herald, Scotland, on Thursday the 26th of October 2023, from the news section. George Square, Glasgow. New images show how heart of city will look. This exclusive article is written by Craig Williams. New images showing how a redesigned George Square could look have been revealed ahead of a planning application being submitted by Glasgow City Council. The features include high-quality stone throughout the square, informal play areas for children in sensory gardens in the eastern areas, a proposed water feature, a raised lawn platform, bespoke sheltered seating, and feature lighting. The main image shows the famous George Square statues relocated, but no final decisions have yet been made. The statues would be removed to be cleaned before returning to the square. The design for the eastern part of the square responds to the formality of the city chambers and of the cenotaph, and further raised green area has been proposed in front of the cenotaph. The design for the western part of the square suggests an area for cafes to spill out, along with paved areas for events, and may include a water feature. A planning application for the redevelopment of the square, Glasgow's most important civic space, is to be submitted shortly by Glasgow City Council. The design for the western part of the square suggests an area for cafes to spill out, along with paved areas for events, and may include a water feature. A planning application for the redevelopment of the square, Glasgow's most important civic space, is to be submitted shortly by Glasgow City Council. This planning application for the developed concept design provides one more opportunity for the communities around George Square and the people of Glasgow to have their say in the design process. Given that aspects of the square have major heritage and historical significance, the application will also be reviewed by Historic Environment Scotland. The application is likely to be submitted in the week commencing October the 30th, with a consultation period likely to be between November and December 2023. If planning consent is given, work on the George Square project is likely to begin in spring 2025, with completion in 2027. The project is funded through the Glasgow City Region City Deal, which is funded by the Scottish and UK governments. That article was written by Craig Williams. This is from the Herald Scotland on Thursday the 26th of October 2023, from the news section. Glasgow soars up the rankings in latest World's Best Cities report. This article is written by Craig Williams. City leaders have welcomed a new global report which has ranked Glasgow as the 61st best city on the planet. The annual World's Best Cities report by global place branding advisor Resonance Consultancy has seen Scotland's largest city soar up the rankings from its 93rd position last year. Glasgow is the second-ranked UK city after London, which came in again as the world's best city, with Manchester 11 places behind at 72. Liverpool was ranked at 74, Birmingham at 85, and Leeds at 88. Resonance praise for Glasgow states that the city powers to its global ranking on the strength of its education, including the planet's 8 most educated citizenry and 36th ranked university, and that startups hungry for cheap space and talent are drawn to the city's working class authenticity. It also praised Glasgow's music scene and nightlife, which it lists as the world's 42nd best, as well as its cultural offering, ranked as 72. It adds, "People not already here are certainly noticing." Lauded as the world's most thorough city ranking, the annual World's Best Cities report is based on methodology that analyses key statistics, user-generated reviews, social media and online activity. The rankings quantify and benchmark qualities of place, reputation and competitive identity for major urban centres. Bloomberg describes the annual report as the most comprehensive study of its kind. It identifies cities that are most desirable for locals, visitors, and business people alike, rather than simply looking at livability or tourism appeal. Council leader Susan Aitken was joined by business chiefs and university leaders in welcoming the findings, which they said were testament to the commitment to developing the skills and qualifications of citizens and hard work in attracting talent and investment to the city. Councillor Aitken said, "In a list dominated by global capitals and long-established A-list urban centres, this is an incredible endorsement for Glasgow. Resonance prides itself on providing investors and visitors with objective rankings, which go far beyond the usual surveys on cities. International recognition like this has the potential to be hugely important in the context of Glasgow's place in a changing international economy. Major investors are making choices factoring in skills, workforces and pipelines of talent, livability and affordability. The World Cities Rankings confirms Glasgow as a genuine global contender, one ready to lure the investment no longer attracted to overpriced capital cities." Stuart Patrick, Glasgow Chamber of Commerce Chief Executive, said, "It's pleasing to see Glasgow's unique attributes recognised by such a robust and comprehensive research consultancy. It really adds credibility to the city's reputation, which continues to evolve. When we consider the rapid growth of innovation, tech and education here, it's perhaps not a surprise to locals, but I'm sure our high ranking will catch the attention of new international investors who continue to see the potential in Glasgow." Professor Sir Jim MacDonald, Principal and Vice-Chancellor of the University of Strathclyde and co-chair of the Glasgow Economic Leadership Board, said, Glasgow is a city with a rich history, a thriving present, wonderful people and a future of vast possibilities. The University of Strathclyde is positioned at the heart of the city and makes a major contribution to its educational, economic and social prosperity. Resonance rightly identifies Glasgow as a city where start-up companies can flourish. In particular, Glasgow City Innovation District, of which Strathclyde is the principal driving force, is a place where these businesses have the infrastructure to develop their enterprising ideas to fruition, driven by great talent, access to leading research, an entrepreneurial spirit, and a step change in private investment levels. Professor Sir Anton Muscatelli, Principal and Vice-Chancellor of the University of Glasgow, said, "I'm delighted to see this result for Glasgow. Our city is home to a variety of talent, with world-leading universities and cutting-edge research and innovation. It's fantastic to see Glasgow's education and entrepreneurship offering cited as reasons for its success. We are proud of the reputation Glasgow has built, with universities like ours working closely with the city government, businesses, stakeholders, and most importantly, our local communities to drive inclusive growth in key sectors like life sciences, quantum technologies, medtech, and through cultural and creative economies. Welcoming Glasgow's rankings, SubClub, Managing Director of the Chair of Nighttime Industries Association Scotland, Mike Grieve, said, "Glasgow has long enjoyed a reputation around the world for the excellence of its nightlife and the live music scene, and I'm delighted to see that recognised. Late night culture is an important driver of the broader cultural imprint of the city and the emergence of world-class record labels and innovative DJ collectives and music producers in Glasgow since the late 1980s has sustained the provenance of our status as world leaders in club culture. The impact this has had on the city is plain to see, as Glasgow continues to attract students and creatives from around the world, informing the future pathway to building a 21st century city centre of genuine substance. In the rankings, Glasgow was bookended either side by Montreal at number 60 and Shanghai at number 62. The top 10 cities were London, Paris, New York, Tokyo, Singapore, Dubai, San Francisco, Barcelona, Amsterdam and Seoul. The world's best cities rankings can be found here. https://www.worldsbestcities.com/rankings/worlds-best-cities/. That article was written by Craig Williams. This is from the Herald Scotland on Thursday the 26th of October 2023 from the news section. McGill's boss claims Putin-style takeover of Glasgow bus firm. This article is written by Katrina Stewart. One of the billionaire co-owners of McGill's bus group has accused wacky transport campaigners of spearheading a Vladimir Putin-esque takeover of his business. His comments to the Herald came following the release of a report from think tank Centre for Cities, commissioned by grassroots group Get Glasgow Moving, which highlights the links between bus networks and employment rates. Sandy Easdale said he could not believe Strathclyde Partnership for Transport, SPT, would consider a plan for nationalisation of the bus network while Scotland is staring into an economic black hole. Mr Easdale accused moves to franchise buses, which will be allowed under new powers that come into force on December the 4th, of being from the Vladimir Putin playbook. Mr. Easdale said, "I am not going to stand by and have my business stolen from me. This is quite simply business confiscation, straight out of the Vladimir Putin playbook. He added, SPT Chief Executive Valerie Davidson has had her head filled with nonsense by wacky activists, and now she's planning a power grab by her organisation, which has sucked on the government teat for years. She even admits that if she was to improve the current network, and that's a big if, it would cost a lot more, but she won't say how much. Considering she's an accountant and has spent almost 18 years at the SPT, she doesn't appear to be displaying much business insight. I mean, 18 years in a leadership role, and you still can't get a Glasgow subway train after 6 p.m. on a Sunday night. Is this what she gets paid almost £180,000 a year for? Miss Davidson had earlier told BBC Scotland, there are a lot of communities in the west of Scotland that don't have access to a bus, particularly in the evenings and at weekends. A decision will be made next spring. Then STP will build a business case, Miss Davidson told the broadcaster, but would not say how much new money for franchising would be needed. She added, I'm not going to preempt that. We already spend in Scotland not far off £500 million in Scotland on public transport for buses. That's a lot of money, but it may well take more. But Mr. Easdale hit back, saying, I suggest she retires and plays more golf and leaves transport issues to those who understand the financial mechanics of the transport industry. She also presumably subscribes to the notion put forward by the Centre for Cities Eggheads, who suggest that Glasgow would become a financial powerhouse if the buses are nationalised. I'm no academic, but I am having difficulty joining the dots here. They say bus franchising would allow more people to get into their jobs in Glasgow. I don't know if Mrs. Davidson has walked about the city recently, but there is no shortage of people getting on and off buses. I would suggest what is preventing Glasgow from becoming a financial powerhouse is that it's dirty, parking charges are exorbitant, high rates are forcing pubs and entertainment venues out of business, and the planning laws are stifling investment. That article was written by Katrina Stewart. This is from the Herald Scotland on Thursday the 26th of October 2023, from the news section. Salmon Scotland sustainable claims greenwash, says complaint. This article is written by Vicky Allen. Campaigners are set to lodge a legal complaint over the use of the word sustainable by the Scottish salmon farming industry, which they claim is greenwashing. The charity Wildfish and the Coastal Communities Network Scotland, CCN, will today submit a dossier of complaints to the Competition and Markets Authority, CMA, which is currently investigating green claims by food and drinks companies. In their submission, the Coalition cites examples of use of the term sustainable by the industry body Salmon Scotland, as well as listing impacts on the environment and wildlife. Rachel Mulreenan, Scotland Director at Wildfish, said, As the CMA recognises, in the minds of consumers, a sustainable product is one that has positive environmental impact, or at least no adverse impact. As our complaint makes clear, the Scottish salmon farming industry can make no such claim, from the unsustainable use of wild fish to feed farmed salmon, to the dispersal of toxic chemicals into Scottish sea lochs, to the negative impact on protected species such as wild Atlantic salmon. This is an inherently unsustainable industry producing an unsustainable product. Among the statements it draws attention to are some published on Salmon Scotland's website. One, for instance, a response to the Scottish Government's vision for sustainable aquaculture, observes that the fish grown sustainably in the sea, off the west coast, and the islands are one of the most nutritious foods to eat, given their high protein and vitamin D levels. Another features on a page covering the Code of Good Practice for Fin Fish Aquaculture, in which the trade body notes, Scottish aquaculture products meet the high quality standards consistent with current and future sustainable development. Yet another is in a news story in which Salmon Scotland heralds the fact that it has joined the Paris-based organisation World Chefs as demand increases at home and abroad for fresh, nutritious and sustainable salmon in restaurants. The unsustainable impacts highlighted in the dossier include, says Wildfish, the negative impact of parasites and escaped fish from Scottish salmon farms on wild salmon, high mortality rates on the farms, unsustainable use of other fish species as parasite, cleaner fish, increasing use of antibiotics on Scottish salmon farms. John Aitchison, spokesperson for CCN, said, "Many Scottish coastal communities have realised how much harm salmon farming can do. Jobs in these communities depend on the sea being clean and healthy, so it is no surprise that this industry has lost its social licence to operate. Every salmon farm is allowed to discharge all its excrement and pesticides into the sea. They all release parasitic sea lice that can threaten wild salmon and sea trout. They bring feed ingredients from across the globe and then fly much of their produce to the USA and the Far East. To make matters worse, the industry wants to double production by 2030, despite farmed fish mortality spiralling upwards, driven by climate change-enhanced diseases and parasites, and the inhumane treatments it administers for these problems. To call any of this behaviour sustainable is unacceptable." The salmon farming industry is not new to criticisms about its sustainability claims. In 2019, the Scottish producer Loch Duart stopped advertising itself as sustainable following an investigation by the Advertising Standards Authority, ASA. Earlier this year, the CMA announced, following the investigation into the fashion industry, that it would be investigating green claims made by companies in the fast-moving consumer goods sector, which includes food and drink products. The complaint also comes in the wake of news that Salmon Scotland is applying to the Department for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs for its protected name to be changed from Scottish Farm Salmon to Scottish Salmon. It's said that the term farmed has become redundant, since nearly all salmon produced in Scotland is farmed. This move has been criticised by environmental and welfare NGOs and campaigners. Ms. Mulrennan said, "As sustainability issues become increasingly important for consumers, we have here not one, but two ways in which the Scottish salmon farming industry is attempting to pull the wool over consumers' eyes." A spokesperson for Salmon Scotland said, "We have been in touch with the CMA, who tell us they have yet to receive anything from these groups. This is simply the latest stunt from two anti-salmon organisations that are campaigning to ban the Scottish salmon sector, which would wipe out thousands of jobs, decimate coastal communities and jeopardise sustainable economic growth for Scotland." That article was written by Vicky Allen.
From the Herald Scotland, Thursday the 26th of October, from the sports section, Souness confirms he is close to Rangers' return as he explains role. Article by Aidan Smith. Graeme Souness has confirmed he is close to agreeing a deal to return to Rangers, with the club looking to appoint the club legend in a consultative role. The Ibrox hero was used as a sounding board as the Glasgow Giants appointed Philip Clement as their new manager this month after sacking Michael Beale. Although Souness's new position will not have an official title, it is understood he will have a say in decisions being made in the football department of the club. Opening up on his talks with Gers, Souness told TalkSport today, "I'm not sure it's a senior advisory role. It's more of a consultant, ambassador, but I'm a Rangers supporter, Jim. I had the chance to go back early season and I didn't feel the job description was right for me, but I'd love to help them. I want them to be successful again. I want them to be top of the league I want them to be top of the Scottish game and do well in Europe going forward. If I can offer any advice to any part of the footballing part of the job, then I'll do it. And I have to say, I'm pretty close to agreeing everything. We've just got a few things to iron out. Souness also opened up on his role in appointing new manager, Philippe Clement. He explained, there were two outstanding candidates, Frank Lampard and Philip. The final say wasn't with me. For me, Frank had the edge because of this. Frank, I think, has still got a great deal to offer. Taking the Chelsea job when he did was always going to be very, very difficult. The Everton job is a basket case. And have they improved since Frank left? Not a bit. So, I wouldn't be too critical of Frank. The thing that encouraged me about Frank is that he wanted to do it. He doesn't need the money. He wants to be a successful manager. And he fancied the Rangers job. And that article was by Aidan Smith.
The Herald on the 27th of October and the news section. Scottish COVID inquiry. Partygate is the ultimate insult by Ginny Sanderson. People who lost their loved ones to COVID were treated as mugs by Partygate, the Scottish COVID inquiry has heard. Jane Morrison, a member of the Scottish COVID bereaved, said the revelations came as the ultimate insult to people who, like her who had been punished for following the rules. Speaking during the third day of the inquiry on Friday, October 7, she said as time went by and conspiracy theories and COVID deniers were becoming more vocal, it was incredibly distressing. But I think the ultimate insult came when all the so-called Partygate stories came out. People became so angry and felt they had been punished for following the rules. They felt they had been treated with absolute contempt, and they felt they had been taken for a ride and treated as mugs. Miss Morrison, whose wife of 30 years, Jackie, died from COVID on 20 October 2020, aged 49, said there was so much anger, it's difficult to find the words to adequately describe. The Perthshire resident was the first witness to speak at the inquiry, which is in its third day in Edinburgh. Miss Morrison's wife, Jackie Morrison Hart, caught COVID while being treated for jaundice at Nines Wells Hospital in Dundee. I couldn't be with her when she was told she was dying, Miss Morrison said. To be there on your own thinking about it and the realisation that that's going on provides its own trauma. However, she was able to be with Jackie in her final moments. She said, I was able to sit with her for 15 minutes before she died. And I sat with her for a while afterwards. The two young male nurses in the ward were lovely. They did everything they could. But she said there were other people who had much worse experiences with their loved ones' care during the pandemic. Miss Morrison said many concerns were due to poor communication from hospital staff during the time leading up to the person's death. She said they are left feeling that their loved one was not being properly looked after or cared for. Some people who were getting little or poor communication felt this was because medical staff didn't care. While the people who weren't able to be there when their loved ones died were left haunted about what happened. Ms. Morrison said whether they were just left to die on their own. Did they know if the death was peaceful or traumatic? When you're not there, your imagination runs riot. I know that many hospitals and care homes try to have someone with a person at this time, but even then it's not a family member. It's not someone who knew and loved them. Many people feel guilt because of this. It's just a natural reaction. I wasn't there for them. One member of the COVID bereaved group was able to be with her father in hospital when he died, Miss Morrison told the inquiry. But immediately after he died, she was taken into a side room where she was sprayed down with something by a nurse. She doesn't know what it was, some kind of disinfectant, and she was told to go home. She was unable to tell her mother, who was in the same hospital, that her husband had died, and her mother died a few days after this. All the members were able to be with their loved ones at the end, but not offer to sit with them for a while afterwards when they died, and they felt they were being rushed out of the hospital. Because of the COVID restrictions, there were people going back on their own to an empty house, unable to have even their own adult children around to come over and support them and help organise the funeral. One woman received a bill of £500 from the council for staying in the property after her parents' death. Ms. Morrison said, and she also spoke about the treatment of families whose loved ones were in care homes. One woman who had an agreement to remove her mother from the care home at any time was told her mother had caught COVID and was receiving end-of-life care. Ms. Morrison said she wanted to take her mother home to nurse her and was threatened with action by the social services. Imagine the trauma of coping with your worst fear realized, your mother has COVID and dying, and on top of that you're having to battle the system and cope with threats. All she wanted to do was enable her mother's final days to be with her daughter, who loves her, and have time to properly care for her. All this, she said, had the trauma of looking through a window, trying to shout messages of love, knowing full well nobody had helped put their loved ones' hearing aids in so they could be heard. Even the final holding of hands was marred because you were wearing gloves. You couldn't even kiss them goodbye. The Scottish COVID inquiry continues. And that was by Ginny Sanderson. The Herald on the 27th of October and the Arts and Ents section. Glasgow Museums, Salvador Dali masterpiece returns to Spain by Craig Williams. It's regarded as one of Scotland's most treasured paintings and the greatest work of art in Glasgow's civic collection. It also proves a major draw for visitors to the city's Kelvin Grove Art Gallery and Museum, helping to make the museum and art gallery one of Scotland's most popular free attractions. Now Salvador Dali's Christ of St. John of the Cross has left Glasgow and returned home for the first time since director of Glasgow Art Galleries and Museums, Dr. Tom Honeyman, secured it for the city for £8,200 more than seven decades ago. Dali's masterpiece has gone on display at the Dali Theatre Museum in the surrealist icon's hometown of Figueres in Catalonia, Spain. The painting, now valued at more than £60 million, is the focus of a new temporary exhibition the largest museum has hosted since it opened nearly 50 years ago, which runs until the end of April next year. The exhibition will also showcase the comprehensive work by the Centre for Dalinian Studies, whose objective is to preserve, catalogue and study the documentary collection that it houses, as well as to foster research onto the most diverse aspects of the oeuvre and life of Salvador Dali. The painting was originally scheduled to arrive at the museum in Figueres, where Dali is buried in an unmarked crypt in November of 2020, but was rescheduled due to the COVID pandemic. Featuring a dramatic depiction of the crucified Christ, which features no thorns, nails, or wounds, the painting was inspired by a drawing Dali was shown by 16th century Carmelite priest John of the Cross, which is preserved in the Convent of the Incarnation in Avila in central Spain. The seascape in the painting is the Bay of Port Lligat, a small village on the Costa Brava where Dali lived and worked from 1930 to 1982. The return of El Cristo de Port Lligat to Spain has been greeted with much fanfare, with one local media site saying that the painting will undoubtedly sum up the Catalan and Spanish cultural season. Dali's The Christ Returns Home, reported Catalan site El Punt Avui. At a press presentation for the new exhibition at the Dali Theatre and Museum on Wednesday, attended by around 100 journalists, the director of the Dali Museums and curator of the exhibition, Montse Agua, said it is an emotional day for the Gala Salvador Dali Foundation. Jordi Mercada, president of the Gala Salvador Dali Foundation, added, "We hope that it will indeed attract a lot of people without being able to anticipate the attendance. But it is a unique exhibition. The painting has never left the Kelvin Grove Art Gallery and Museum in Glasgow." The Dali Theatre Museum confirmed that given the importance of the temporary exhibition, the entire area of the museum's Logius Room in Torre Galatea, Dali's last residence, has been adapted to host the exhibition. A museum spokesperson said the exhibition will allow us to revisit a work that had not been seen in Spain since 1952, when it was exhibited in Madrid and Barcelona. And even more importantly, it will allow us to enter the artist's universe and explore the relevance of Dali's workshop in the day of Port Legat, located in a landscape without which the painting would not acquire its full meaning. The exhibition project will provide art lovers with new contributions based on recent research, preparatory drawings and archival material, some of which is previously unpublished. The museum also thanked Glasgow Museums for the invaluable collaboration and for loaning one of its most precious pieces for the temporary exposition. Loaned to the Dali Theatre and Museum is the fourth time Dali's Christ of St John of the Cross has left Glasgow since 2010, when it spent 6 months on display at the High Museum of Art in Atlanta at an exhibition of the Surrealist artist's work. The painting then left Glasgow again in September of 2017 before returning to the city in the summer of 2018, having featured in a Dali Duchamp exhibition in London's Royal Academy of Arts before the exhibition travelled to the Dali Museum in St. Petersburg, Florida. Dali's Christ of St. John of the Cross was last loaned out by Glasgow Life Museums to the Auckland Project in County Durham from July to December last year, alongside another Spanish masterpiece in El Greco's Christ of the Cross. And that was by Craig Williams.
From the Herald Scotland, Sunday the 29th of October, from the sports section, Rangers 2, Hearts 1, Danilo and Tavernier, Magic, seal unlikely comeback, report by Matthew Lindsay. Rangers came from behind to snatch an unexpected victory against Hearts at Ibrox this afternoon and reduced Celtic's lead at the top of the Cinch Premiership table to 5 points. With the top flight leaders being held to a 0-0 draw by Hibernian at Easter Road yesterday, their city rivals had an opportunity to draw closer and breathe life into the Scottish title race. But James Tavernier and his teammates looked out of sorts in the wake of the Europa League encounter with Sparta Prague in the Czech Republic on Thursday and fell behind in the 5th minute to a Lauren Shankland header. Tavernier struck the post with a penalty and added on time at the end of first half, and it looked very much as if the home side were going to end up on the receiving end of an agonising and costly defeat. But referee John Beaton awarded Rangers a second spot kick with 2 minutes of regulation time remaining after spotting that Peter Haring had pulled down Conor Goldson on his pitchside monitor. On this occasion, the right back made no mistake. More drama was to follow in the 9 minutes of injury time when Beaton added on when Danilo rose and made a Tavernier cross and nodded in a sharp header that proved to be the winner. It was a sore one for Stephen Nath's side, but Philip Clement's team deserved the victory and all 3 points for battling to the death. Here are 5 talking points from a thrilling afternoon in Govan. Euro hangover. Clement made just one change to the team which took to the field in Prague 3 days earlier. Ridvan Yilmaz came back in at left back, having missed out in the midweek match because he was omitted from the European squad by Michael Beale, and John Souter dropped to the bench. Would there be a European hangover for the hosts? Going with 9 of the 10 outfield players who had taken to the field in the Letna Stadium on Thursday was something of a gamble. That said, the manager did not exactly have an abundance of options on the bench. Danilo and Jose Cifuentes are just returning from injury. It was Turkish internationalist Yilmaz who was at fault for the opener in the 5th minute anyway. He failed to clear a cross from Cochran to Shankland. It was, to be fair to the wing-back, a fine delivery. However, the defender should really have been more switched on. The £3.5 million signing has shown occasional glimpses of what he is capable of since moving to Glasgow last summer. His first team appearances have been restricted by the presence of Borna Barisic, but he has to start doing more to justify his transfer fee. Shankland for Scotland. Hearts captain Shankland ended a barren 8-game run without a goal last weekend when he netted in the second half of his side's 4-1 mauling by Celtic in Gorgie. He immediately vowed that he would build on his strike and was true to his word. He did superbly to nod beyond Jack Butland and put the visitors in front early on. He also showed he is, despite the accusations which are often aimed in his direction, far more than a penalty box poacher before half-time. He cleared a Conor Goldson header, which took a deflection off of Cyril Dessers off the Hearts goal line, and then supplied his fellow forward Kenneth Vargas with a scoring opportunity in the final third. The Capital Club skipper was left out of the Scotland squad by national manager Steve Clarke for the doubleheader against Spain and France earlier this month. If the 28-year-old, who took his tally for the 2023-24 campaign to 7, maintains his current form, he has a chance of earning a recall for the Euro 2024 qualifiers against Georgia and Norway. Danilo Delight. Rangers, it seemed, just like their City rivals Celtic at Easter Road 24 hours earlier, could find no way through their opponents. Abdallah Sima squared across the face of goal. Nobody was there to turn it in. Goldson got an attempt on target. Shanklin saved the day. John Lundstrom unleashed a powerful shot. Frankie Kent threw his body in front of it. Then, Todd Cantwell won a penalty when he was tripped by Toby Sibbich. Tavernier, normally so clinical from 12 yards out, though stuck the inside of the left post with his effort, and nobody in a light blue jersey turned in the rebound. It was looking to be one of those days for the hosts, until suddenly it wasn't. A huge cheer went up around the ground when Danilo, still wearing a protective face mask, replaced Dessers at the start of the second half. The Brazilian has hardly fared much better than his club mate since arriving in this country. Still, the home supporters clearly felt that he was a better bet for a goal. They were proved right. The substitute produced the goods when it mattered most. It will do his confidence a world of good and help him to put his difficult start at Rangers firmly behind him. Raskin Crocked. Rangers midfielder Nicholas Raskin was stretchered off injured with his head in his hands in the second half, sparking fears that he could be out for some time to come. The Belgian midfielder, who had opened his account for Rangers with a long-range strike against Hibs 8 days earlier, fell to the ground after hitting the side netting. It was not his best performance, but he will be badly missed if he is sidelined long-term. Cup semi-appetizer. These two teams will do battle in the Viaplay Cup semi-final at Hampden next weekend, and if that encounter is as half as entertaining as this one, it will be an absolute cracker. Hearts will not lack motivation. They will, too, have a belief they can, with more supporters roaring them on, get the triumph. Rangers will have to perform far better to avoid another last four exit. And that report was by Matthew Lindsay. From the Herald Scotland, Saturday the 28th of October. From the news section, exclusive. Anger as Glasgow HSCP rejects community link worker cash. This article is an exclusive by Helen McArdle, health correspondent. The row over controversial cuts to community links workers in Glasgow's poorest neighbourhoods has taken a new twist amid claims that the city's health and care bosses secretly rejected an offer by the Scottish Government to cover half the costs. Trade Union GMB, which represents the GP surgery staff who are to be made redundant unless the proposals are reversed, has demanded an explanation from Suzanne Miller, the Chief Officer for the Glasgow Health and Social Care Partnership, GHSCP, over unacceptable decisions which it said ride roughshod over local democracy. Glasgow's health and social care bosses previously said they would be forced to slash the number of full-time community link worker, CLW posts, from 70 to 42 from April next year because the Scottish Government was discontinuing a £1.35 million funding pot which had been used to pay for the scheme. However, in a letter shared with the Herald, Rory Steele, the Policy and External Relations Officer for GMB Scotland, says the trade union has been reliably informed by the Scottish Government that a formal, written offer was made in September for half of the funding to be provided, a sum of around £700,000, not just for 1 year but on a recurring basis, and that this offer was rejected by GCHSCP. Mr. Steele said the GMB had spoken to numerous councillors who sit as voting members on the board but who insisted that they were unaware of any official offer having been made. Mr. Steele added, the implications of this are that councillors who are responsible for making major spending decisions on Glasgow's services and who are accountable to the electorate have not only been denied the opportunity to decide on the offer, but they've also not even been notified. Instead, GCH SCP officers have made the decision themselves to reject the offer, make several of our members redundant in the middle of the cost of living crisis, and leave the most deprived communities with a significantly reduced service, which would assist them with their health, economic and social issues. It is unacceptable for unelected officers to ride roughshod over local democracy and not respect due process or the role of elected councillors. He added that the government's offer was specific to Glasgow, and also questioned why HSCP could not dip into its £9 million reserve to make up the difference. The HSCP insists that there are some misunderstandings in the letter, but a spokeswoman confirmed that it did receive, and respond to, a formal offer from the Scottish Government earlier this week. She added, "We are keen to continue discussions with Scottish Government, but their offer of funding has been contingent on us diverting additional money from other overstretched services. It's not something we can comply with, given the very serious financial difficulties we are facing across all our businesses." A spokeswoman for the Scottish Government said, "We have been offered additional funding to help them resolve this issue, and it's a matter for the HSCP in Glasgow to decide if they wish to take up this offer. We are clear that community-linked workers must continue to provide a vital service in disadvantaged areas." The revelations come days after the Herald reported that Health Secretary Michael Matheson had told key stakeholders during the SNP conference that the government was open to meeting the HSCP halfway to prevent the job losses. There has been a fierce backlash since the planned cuts were outlined by the HSCP in August, with GPs and charities warning of a catastrophic impact on the city's poorest residents. Community link workers are employed by HSCP but embedded in Glasgow's deep-end GP practices, located in the city's most deprived communities. They provide dedicated support for non-medical problems affecting patients' health, such as issues with debt, housing, loneliness, food and fuel poverty, and abuse, and are seen as a vital resource for tackling widening health inequalities. Christiana Mellum, Chief Executive of the National Association of Link Workers UK, said the unnecessary anxiety inflicted on Glasgow's CLWs by the current uncertainty is nothing short of heart-wrenching. She added, "The outcry for resolution is more than overwhelming. It's a passionate plea for justice and compassion concerning patients in Glasgow. The deafening silence from Glasgow HSCP is disheartening, to say the least. We urgently call for transparency and effective communication from both parties to swiftly put an end to this distressing situation, ensuring that patient wellbeing remains the top priority, and let CLWs continue their essential work unhindered." And that article was an exclusive by Helen McArdle. From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 30th of October, from the news section, Cumbernauld, appeal after attempted robbery and assault of taxi driver. Article by Craig Williams. Police are appealing for information following the assault and attempted robbery of a taxi driver in Cumbernauld. The driver was approached by a man while he was parked at the bus stop on Blackthorn Road at Rowan Road around 12:30 a.m. on Sunday. The man assaulted the driver and demanded he hand over money. He is described as wearing a blue/black jacket and a disposable face mask. He was carrying a white carrier bag. Detective Sergeant Karen Murray said, "While the taxi driver was not seriously injured, he was left extremely shaken by this incident. Our inquiries are ongoing and we are keen to trace this man. I would ask anyone who is in the area around this time and recognises this description of the man, or perhaps has a relevant dashcam footage which could assist us, to get in touch. Anyone with any information is asked to contact 101, quoting incident 0192 of Sunday, the 29th October, 2023, and that article was by Craig Williams. From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 30th of October, from the news section, Israel-Gaza war, Sunak to chair COBRA meeting on domestic threat. Report by Craig Williams. Rishi Sunak is to chair an emergency COBRA meeting amid fears that the conflict between Israel and Gaza could have increased the domestic terror threat to Britain. The Prime Minister will assemble police and national security officials and Home Secretary Suella Braverman in Downing Street on Monday morning, Whitehall sources said. Education Minister Robert Halfson stressed before the meeting that the government has to ensure British citizens are safe and secure from the threat of terrorism. He declined to say whether the terror threat level might be raised. It currently stands at substantial in England, Wales and Scotland, meaning an attack is likely. It has been at that level since February last year when it was lowered from severe, meaning an attack is highly likely. Asked on Times Radio whether the terror threat level could be raised in the UK, Mr Halfon said, "I'm not at that Cobra meeting. I'm sure it will be announced later on. But, of course, we have to make sure that British citizens are safe and secure from the threat of terrorism, as the government always does." Metropolitan Police Commissioner Sir Mark Rowley warned on Sunday that terrorism has been accelerated by events in the Middle East, as he raised concerns about state threats from Iran. Meanwhile, Foreign Secretary James Cleverly is in Abu Dhabi for talks on getting humanitarian aid into Gaza and allowing civilians, including British nationals, to leave. He said the United Arab Emirates has had a thoughtful and authoritative voice on aid as he meets Emirati Foreign Minister Sheikh Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan. And that article was by Craig Williams. From the Herald Scotland, Monday the 30th of October, from the news section, McGill's axes evening services to keep everyone safe after attacks. Article by Craig Williams. A bus operator has been forced to withdraw services to an area of Scotstown due to attacks on their buses. McGill's took to X on Sunday to advise passengers that its 3 and 51 services would not serve the Auchinbach area of Barrhead due to previous attacks to its buses. The number 3 service normally passes through Auchinbach while operating a route from Glasgow's Hope Street to Neilston, while the 51 service normally begins slash ends at Auchinbach on a route to Paisley. The bus operator said it awaits the support of Police Scotland before reinstating the bus routes. McGill's also halted evening services to the area on Friday and Saturday in an effort to keep everyone safe. Back in April, First Glasgow threatened to withdraw services to the Pollock area of Glasgow due to a rise in the number of arson attacks on the buses. The bus operator said at the time it was seeking joint response from community leaders to address the amount of criminal and antisocial behaviour in the area. Police confirmed local officers will be on both First Glasgow and McGill's West services in uniform and plain clothes to help reassure the public. And that article was by Craig Williams. From the Herald Scotland, Sunday the 29th of October, from the business section, Business Week, Scotland flights, Edinburgh Airport JetBlue New York route. Article by business correspondent Brian Donnelly. A Scottish airport has welcomed the launch of an American airline's first route between the US and Scotland. The response came as business correspondent Kirsty Dorsey reported that low-cost carrier JetBlue is setting up in Edinburgh next year. The airline is to launch its first Scottish link with a new New York route set up. Gordon Dewar, chief executive of Edinburgh Airport, said, "It's always a big moment when we welcome an airline to Edinburgh for the first time, and the arrival of JetBlue will be an exciting step as we further strengthen our links to North America. Edinburgh and New York are both hugely popular places to visit, and I'm thrilled that this new service will provide even more opportunities to connect between two of the world's greatest cities." Hotel in famed Scottish golfing region sold. An East Lothian hotel, which attracts golf enthusiasts thanks to its proximity to a range of high-quality courses, has been acquired by a Northern Ireland investor for an undisclosed sum. Investment company Wirefox has added Ducks Inn in Aberlady to a leisure portfolio, which includes St Andrews Golfing Hotel the Ardermen and the Bushmills Inn of Northern Ireland. Ducks Inn is the third property which Wirefox has placed in its Mariam Hotel collection. It had been put up for sale by long-standing owners Malcolm and Fiona Duck, who had helmed the 23-bedroom hotel for 19 years. Famous family-run Glasgow restaurant to open in Edinburgh. A Glasgow favourite is to open a new restaurant in the Scottish capital. Family business Rusk and Rusk has said it is to open the Spanish Butcher, an award-winning dining concept, on North Castle Street in spring 2024. The independent Scottish restaurant group has been operating its steakhouse offering in Scotland for almost 15 years. The new 90-cover restaurant will offer vibrant Spanish and Mediterranean-inspired flavours across an a la carte menu, married with the very best homegrown produce from Scotland's larder. It said that, inspired by New York's neighbourhood dining scene and the lustworthy loft-style vibes of the city, the Spanish Butcher in Edinburgh will be quintessentially modern, hip and hospitable, and present a downright delicious offering. And that was this week's Business Week, brought to you by Brian Donnelly.
This is from the Herald Scotland of Tuesday, the 31st of October 2023, from the business section. Scotland 5G. Crover Grain Swimming Robot, Innovate UK Funding. This article is by Ian McConnell. An Edinburgh business has won funding for its grain swimming robot, which can be deployed in sheds and silos with the aim of giving farmers and storage operators accurate insights into the condition of their crops. Crover, a robotics and agri-tech firm, has secured £50,000 from the UK's Innovation Agency to progress its study of remote autonomous operations of the grain swimming robot, harnessing artificial intelligence. The Scotland 5G Centre, S5GC, and CEED, the Centre for Engineering, Education and Development, supported Crover with its bid for the funding from Innovate UK. The next stage of testing by Crover is being conducted in S5GC's Forth Valley Innovation Hub. Scottish 5G Centre said, by swimming through grain, the Grover robot provides in-situ stirring of the grain, which helps maintain its quality, as well as improving the health and safety of grain storage operations. He added that the new funding will support Crover in making its system smarter by enhancing its autonomous operating capabilities using artificial intelligence solutions and improving the efficiency of data transmission, including through 5G protocols, to provide even more insight to grain handlers. Without the Crover robot, post-harvest losses during storage can be anywhere between 2% and 10% each year, S5GC noted. And they said of Crover's offering, it will also help grain storage operators reduce losses and maintain optimum storage conditions, creating a platform that can be integrated into existing monitoring systems that will improve the efficiency substantially or substitute them completely. Lorenzo Conti, founder and managing director of Crover, said, we are delighted about the support, helping us take our mission of enabling humanity to reach below the surface further, and we look forward to the new collaboration with the Scotland 5G Centre and the Centre for Engineering, Education and Development. Automation will no doubt benefit grain storage operators hugely. However, without a mechanism to report learnings and captures by the Crover robot, all this effort is wasted. Being able to test the system in an environment like the Scottish 5G Centre has within its innovation hubs is invaluable and will be of huge benefit to myself and the team. Tom Marchbanks, Business Engagement Manager for Scottish 5G Centre at Forth Valley, said, it has been great to support Lorenzo and his team with their successful bid for Innovate UK funding. The value that 5G technologies can provide to organisations of any shape, size and sector knows no bounds. It is our mission to support innovative SMEs, small and medium-sized enterprises, that are passionate about future-proofing their operations to bring their ideas to life. A connected world relies on innovation, collaboration and open-mindedness So it's fantastic to see Scottish businesses like Crover paving the way. Joe Pasiti, Managing Director for the Centre of Engineering, Education and Development, said, "We are really pleased to be able to help many of our members around a range of support activities and connections. Where Crover is concerned, helping the business through signposting for partners previously, and in this case directing them to funding partners and seeing a successful outcome, is really great news. Helping early stage companies to find both funding mechanisms and industry partners is an area we at the Centre for Education, Engineering and Development are increasingly helping members to navigate their way through." That article was by Ian McConnell. This is from the Herald Scotland of Tuesday, the 31st of October, from the business section. Scotland economy. Fall in young people starting apprenticeships. This article is by Craig Williams. The number of apprenticeship starts by 16 to 24-year-olds in Scotland has dropped by more than 5,800 over the last decade, according to research. Analysis by the Chartered Institute of Personnel and Development also found the number of apprenticeship starts by those aged 25 and over increased by 5,400 over the same period. The professional body for HR and people development said the change came despite the Scottish Government's apprenticeship policy seeking to prioritise younger people. In response, the body is calling on the government to expand flexible skills funding for employers and employees and to improve business support services for small and medium-sized enterprises. The Chartered Institute for Personnel and Development also believes recent reforms have failed to reverse a decline in employer training, with UK investment in training per employee standing at about half that of the EU average. The fall has happened despite the number of skills shortage vacancies more than doubling in Scotland in 5 years, from 17,827 in 2017 to 36,806 in 2022. Marek Zemanek, Senior Public Policy Advisor for the Chartered Institute of Personnel and Development in Scotland and Northern Ireland, said, "Skills and labour shortages continue to be a real problem across Scotland and all sectors of the economy, and we need to get apprenticeships and vocational education right if we're to tackle these challenges. Apprenticeships should primarily be pathways that provide young people with in-depth quality training in a workplace setting, but too many are simply missing out. Introducing apprenticeship hiring incentives and expanding flexible skills funding for employers will help boost skills development opportunities for employees, but employers themselves must step up too. Investment in training and development is critical in addressing skill gaps and improving workplace productivity, but it continues to decline in Scotland. The Chartered Institute of Personnel and Development has set out a range of recommendations it believes will address the issue, such as expanding the Flexible Workforce Development Fund. It also recommends refocusing the scope of apprenticeship policy to include a discussion on direct financial incentives and introducing fast-track routes to apprenticeship qualifications for adults with existing workplace skills. Mr. Zemanek said, "Despite the importance of SMEs to Scotland's economy, there are still major barriers in their engagement with the current skills system, including its complexity, lack of resources, and poor people management capability. Good quality advisory and business support services aimed at boosting management capability and increasing understanding of skills development are key to engaging small businesses." That article was by Craig Williams.
The Herald on the 31st of October and the Arts and Ents section. Meet Katie Gregson-McLeod, the Scottish star who found fame on TikTok, by Alex Burns. 9 million people is a lot of people. It's the same population as Scotland and Wales combined, and it's also the number of people who viewed a 60-second clip of Inverness musician Katie Gregson-McLeod singing her breakout hit Complex on TikTok. Katie had just over 1,000 followers on the platform when she first posted the video of herself performing the self-written piano ballad in August last year. Within 24 hours, she had hundreds of thousands of new followers, and within 2 weeks, she had a recording contract with Columbia Records, the label of Harry Styles and Bob Dylan, among others. She is the poster child of this new type of TikTok star, with the platform offering an opportunity for those without any significant following to go viral overnight. There's no longer any need to haul yourself through an X Factor-style talent show or slog around pubs playing music. All you need is a good song and the favour of the algorithm. Yet while appreciative for the success that social media has brought her, 22-year-old Katie is determined to make a name for herself beyond the label of TikTok. TikTok has been instrumental to my progress, she explains, and I'll always be eternally grateful for the audience it's given me. But I also want to give context that I've been writing music for years, so although it's an overnight thing, there's a lot of preparation for that moment. Music has always been there for Katie, who learned to play the guitar, piano and clarinet while growing up in Inverness. Yet, although she felt she wanted to pursue music as a career, it was difficult to foresee the best way to get into the industry. For so many jobs, you know the classic route into that career. You know what degree to do and what path to take. I found it hard having nobody around me who was in the music industry who could give me advice. She decided to move to Edinburgh to study history at university, playing at open mic events and folk clubs while writing music in her spare time. In 2021, she decided to download TikTok, a video sharing app that's hugely popular with younger generations, and began sharing clips of some of her original songs. I tend to overshare, she laughs, which applies to my music as well, so I've never felt weird about posting music I've written, even though the songs are quite vulnerable. It was that vulnerability that perhaps caused Complex to become so popular so quickly, with the simplicity of the sentiment of unrequited love offering near universal appeal. Katie posted it on TikTok and then went to bed, unaware she had just created a seismic shift in her fortunes. I woke up the next day to see the comments and the shares were flooding in. I started to get seen by people at the top of the game musically, US stars like Camila Cabello, and interest from record labels. It feels like a fever dream when you're in it. I posted it on the Thursday night, and by that weekend my whole life was different. Within 2 weeks she had a manager and signed to a major record label, with headline shows and festival slots following soon after. Yet Katie herself admits she's still unsure quite why the song went viral in the way it did. I will never know exactly why it was that song that took off. There was something in it that seemed to resonate with people, maybe because it's a very vulnerable song. I wrote it from a very personal place, but a lot of people relate to it. She is currently working on a debut album with homecoming gigs in Edinburgh and Glasgow scheduled for the end of November. But Katie says her ambition is huge, with plans to build on the connection she has formed with her fans. I will always be grateful for TikTok, she says, but I would eventually love for that to be a footnote in my story. Katie Gregson-McLeod plays Edinburgh Summer Hill Hall on November 30 and Glasgow King Tut's on December 3. And that was by Alex Burns.
That concludes this week's edition of the Hair in Scotland podcast. Please remember to subscribe to our channels at Hair and Review. Tell your friends about our service.